Okay, so I'm really glad you're here this morning. I hope that you don't run out of here screaming after what we do. No, it'll be all right. But I'm going to take a risk this morning and present something I haven't presented before. And hopefully it will fly or at least bumble on the runway.
About mindfulness?
What?
You're going to show us about mindfulness?
No, not about mindfulness. Something else. Okay. Okay, a couple of announcements first. Julie.
You think it talks behind next Saturday.
Daylight savings time ends on Saturday midnight, something like that?
Yeah, let's see.
Sunday 2 a.m.? Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Okay. Bring writing materials and something to write on next week. We are going to do a personal growth exercise next week, okay? So bring writing materials and some hard surface to write on. Let's see. Also, we're going to have an art fair next week. If possible, get here a little early. Set up your art around the room. And we'll get a chance before class to look at it. And then we'll probably end class a little early so we have time after class to look at it. Don't be shy about bringing your artwork. The way I deal with other people's opinions about my artwork, it's all totally subjective anyway, and if they don't see the beauty and wonder in it, it's their problem. It's good. You gotta overcome your inner critic and get this stuff out there, you know. People will appreciate it. And you'll appreciate it. Okay, registration for spring. Next week is the last class of the fall term for this class. In the spring, I guess we start again on January 18th.
Yeah, that makes sense in the office, yeah.
Yeah, okay. So you can begin registering on December 11th for any non-credit class, and for any fee-based class, December 13th. So December 11th, I think, is the non-credit when it opens for registration. December 13th for fee-based. So those of you who are taking fee-based courses where it fills up, you want to pay attention to December 13th, right? Because if it fills up, you can't get in.
What about your class? What date do we do that?
December 11th.
Okay.
And what's it going to be called? Or what class number is it?
What's this?
What is it going to be called or what class number?
I don't know what class number it's the same. My class is the same class. It's the only one to stay approved 5 years ago, so we're stuck by that title. But actually, I was thinking in the middle of the night last night that it's not going to be consciousness, science, and the nature of being. It's going to be called some consciousness, science, and the nature of well-being. Because I think I'm going to especially look at the latest developments in what makes us live well. So that unless I change my mind, that will be emphasis in the spring on well-being. So add this syllable well to the title of the class.
I'll use that later, I hate it.
Okay, so a little bit about mindfulness. Oh, any other announcements? All right, a little about mindfulness. When you sit and you breathe and you open up, stuff comes up. Okay, people who have never done it before think they're going to kind of dissociate and forget about everything or get blissed out. And often they do because they're not really being mindful. They're just kind of letting go. But when you practice mindfulness, you come in, Lauren. Come sit down, otherwise I'll distract you. Yeah, sit down somewhere.
Can we close the door to that sound?
No, let's leave it open because of the breeze that has to come through, hopefully. Hopefully. So when you practice mindfulness, as opposed to just kind of spacing out or losing consciousness, then stuff happens, stuff comes up because you're opening up. And some of the stuff that comes up is pleasant, and some of the stuff that comes up is not so pleasant, and some of the stuff that comes up is really unpleasant. And the instruction is to just notice it and not get caught in it. Not try to do anything about it, get rid of it, change it, make it better, heal it, but you just notice it. You just see that it's part of your conditioning. It's part of the way that you have learned to assemble your world, and you just sit with it. So how does that do any good? How is that healing in any sense? It turns out that there's a huge paradox here. It's more healing, generally, than anything you could do to try to heal that which has come up. So how can that be? Doing nothing is superior to doing something? Here's why. Or here's one way why. When this stuff gets unrepressed, when it comes up from wherever it has been hidden, it can be pretty disturbing. It has an emotional charge to it. It's not only the content that comes up, it's the emotion that comes up with it. But when you're sitting and you're breathing and you're softening and opening, you're establishing a calm, peaceful, unperturbed inner state in which stuff is coming up. Right? So you've got two things happening. You've got a calm, unperturbed, open awareness, and you've got problematic material, contracted material coming up. And what happens is these things get paired over and over again. And as they get paired, the problematic stuff starts to take on a larger, more peaceful emotional tone. Called counter-conditioning. Two things happening at once that are different. After a while, they either blend or one turns into the other. In this case, the contracted stuff opens into the expansion. Nature abhors a vacuum, which is, you know, contracted will go like this. So just by noticing what's coming up, if it's problematic, and not trying to do anything about it, but just sitting with it and feeling the pain and feeling the difficult feelings as they happen, just letting it be the show that you watch. If you do that over and over again, when the material comes up, it gradually lessens in its emotional difficulty. It gradually releases its contraction. The way that Carl Jung put this, I still want to leave it open. It's okay, it's fast. The way Jung put it, Carl Jung put it, is we have these areas in our personality called complexes, okay? And when they're like floating islands in an otherwise okay personality. And when they get activated, they take over. And they define you. But what he said, not knowing anything about mindfulness, he said, if you over and over again experience this complex taking you over, after a while what happens is it still comes up, but it doesn't completely consume you. And as time goes on, it comes up and it's less and less compelling. And finally, it comes up and it just fades away. It has lost its power over you. Because you've paired a non-judgmental, unattached awareness with whatever it is that's come up. So the way you heal a complex, according to Jung, is you just over and over again experience it until it lessens in its how much it governs you. So to come back to mindfulness, the way to deal with the difficult stuff that comes up is you just, as Jack Kornfield says, you bow to it. Or as Rumi says, in the guest house, whatever comes, you just welcome it. Because, you know, it has a utility, ultimately. So understand, by doing nothing, you actually allow, by not operating on what comes up, you actually allow that stuff to spontaneously open up, soften up. Integrate in the personality. Heal. Okay. So, I mean,
what ultimately happens is you recognize that all of that is not you, and you are the one that's observing it all. I mean, just the you.
Okay, so another way I would put it, I understand what you're saying, but I think it's a different level of you. It's a way that you have learned to arrange your attention. So the central you, the real you, is the watcher. But these habits of arranging the world, they're part of you too. They're just peripheral. They're spokes rather than the hub of the wheel.
Yeah, I'm speaking of the essence of you, the spirit.
Yeah. The essence of you is interior to that, absolutely. Okay, so let's sit. Now, that doesn't mean difficult stuff is going to come up. You don't go fishing. Because you can pull up, if you go fishing, you can pull up a hell of a whale, you know. You don't do that. The idea is when you sit, you surrender. You just open to whatever happens. And sometimes it's a snooze. Sometimes it's blank. Sometimes it's you're thinking about something. Sometimes it's your breathing. I mean, it's whatever it is, it just is. And your job is just to be with what is, not to try to rearrange what is, just to be with it. So let's sit for 10 minutes. Supermind at the Garvin Theater. It's sold out. But if you, because some people won't show up who have tickets, especially if they got free tickets, there might be some extra seats. Can't be guaranteed of that. But if you really want to go see Gene Twenge talk about what the kids are doing and what the implications are for the world, then I would suggest going early and asking the registration people to put you on a list in case there are extra seats. Also, I think that there may be one usher still needed, in which case you get in free for doing the ushering. If you're interested in that, see me and I'll tell you who to email. I don't know if that's still the case or not. So what I want to do now is present a psychological theory of everything. I have I have presented parts of this to some of you before, but I've never put it all together in this fashion. So hopefully this won't be just an academic exercise. It will have implications for how you look at yourself and how we treat one another. Okay? And I will use the board a little bit. So if you can't hear, let me know and I will use this device. But hopefully I won't need it. Okay. So first of all, this is a theory, this is not reality, okay? This is a model of the psyche. Theories are, science is an attempt to model reality. And it's never going to be probably won't be a totally good attempt because reality is beyond modeling. But the human mind wants to understand, and so theories get better and better at modeling aspects of reality. So this is a model of your psyche. This is not the last word. Clear, but, all right, so, and this is a theory of psychological functioning. This is not a theory of psycho-spiritual function. Okay? There is a spiritual dimension that precedes this theory that we've talked about a lot, that this theory is a part of a larger understanding of psycho-spiritual reality. So this is the part that has to do with your mind, psychological reality. So it's a psychological theory of everything, not a psycho-spiritual theory of everything. But hopefully, given this schema, you can understand anything about your behavior and the behavior of others. So it's the theory starts from a fundamental change that happened in the universe. As far as we know, up until about 4 billion years ago, the universe was non-living. We don't know that for sure. It could have, some other place could have had life start at some point, but all we know about is on this Earth and what we perceived so far out there, nothing was living until somehow organic molecules started to arrange themselves into something that could self-replicate, and life arose approximately 4 billion years ago on this planet. Which is not long after this planet was formed. This planet was formed 4.56 billion years ago when the solar system was formed. So pretty soon thereafter, this process of life started to happen. But that was a fundamental change. Now the universe had two things in it, non-life and life. And life differs from non-life in one very, very, very important way. Life wants to continue as life. When you hit a rock, the rock falls apart. It doesn't try to reassemble itself. But when you injure a tree will heal itself. So life has a motive to continue, and life is precarious. If life doesn't do what it needs to do to continue, it will fall back into non-life. Non-life is the state from which life constructs itself. And unless it is successful at reconstructing itself, non-life happens. So there's a fundamental different two things in the universe. The whole of the universe gave rise to the yin and the yang of non-life and life. So the fundamental motive behind everything that every living creature does, from the smallest living creature to the most complex living creature, the fundamental motive is to stay alive. Okay? So I call that the fundamental dynamic, because I need words that... So that's the fundamental dynamic of life, is to stay alive. Three basic motives. Okay, life's three basic motivations. So I got to write, just to kind of review here. I'm not going to put very much down, but first we get life. And then we get three basic motives, and those motives are, and every living creature is at the base working all the time on these motives.
Spencer, it's actually called autopoiesis.
Yeah, the self-organizing capacity of life. That's a fancy word for it.
Right.
So these are the three basic motives of life. All living things need to continue, and then because life wants to continue, and life hasn't figured out yet to be how to be eternal, every living thing wants to bring life forward. So this is how life continues, is it survives and then it procreates. Help. Life wants the most life to continue. I look at the fundamental motive as life, and life wants the most life to continue. So many creatures are motivated not only to survive and procreate, but to help other creatures survive and procreate. So it's a basic motive because it maximizes the amount of life that persists. Not all creatures are like that. Some creatures are competitive with other people, but many creatures have a motive of creating the most life, not just their life. So those are the three basic motives. Okay. There are two basic strategies to getting these motives satisfied. There are two ways that life persists. Two things we do to survive and procreate and help. We approach that which is life-giving, and we avoid that which is life-taking. And you see this in very primitive creatures, you know, who will, paramecia will swim toward the food you put on a slide, and they'll swim away from the poison that you put on the other side of the slide. Plants will bend toward the sun, and they'll bend away from noxious influence. You know, so this approach avoid thing is very deep, and in humans, there are two basic setups in the brain, if you will. One setup is the setup that gets you to go toward that which will increase your life, and the other setup is the setup that gets you to go away from that which is inimical to your life. We'll talk more about that, okay? Life decided somehow to come in two varieties. Somehow it was better for life's success to split itself into plants and animals. And both plants and animals show this pattern of approach and avoid. Okay. So let's look now particularly at animals. In animals,
let's do it the other way so it is less confusing. More clear.
Yeah. So in animals, in order to survive, in order to succeed in life, life evolved a mind. They have evolved the mind in plants too, but I don't know about that. In animals, life evolved the mind with three basic capacities.
Sensation. Emotion and thought.
And these evolve sequentially. Sensation is more basic. The motion is above, it is less basic, more evolutionarily advanced, and thought is the most evolutionary advanced. So, Vernon.
Yes, you say life survives, ghosts survive, but how do you figure humans being the quote-unquote most intelligent beings on the planet? We make cigarettes, and then we smoke cigarettes, and we kill ourselves, and the people that make the cigarettes are trying to
When I get to it, I'll show you how that's a perversion of a healthy aspect of the brain. It's, human beings have figured out how to make unnatural things which pervert this whole process. But let's get there, okay? So Barry.
Well, more basic than that, humans choose whether or not to procreate. I don't think there's any other species that decides whether or not it's going to procreate.
And that decision to decide whether or not to procreate is often based on not only what's happening with oneself, but what's happening around oneself. I think a lot of people are not procreating because it's better for the species if there aren't too many people. And I think that influences people. But whether or not you actually procreate, okay, it's clear that your motive is to help life continue. So whether you have your own baby or not, you have some motive to help all humanity. So for some people, it's a personal procreation, whether it's moving, it's babying the whole society. It depends on a lot of factors. Okay, so Colette.
I'm just wondering why we live so long after we procreate. What's the function?
There's two basic answers to the question of why we live so long after we procreate. Answer one is it's a mistake that evolution would rather just have us off the planet once we've done our job. But the other interesting idea that I hear a lot is to steer the course of the world's development in a healthy way, that is, wisdom seems to be helpful to life. Okay. If you have just a bunch of young people, they do a bunch of stupid stuff sometimes. But if you have older people in a tribe, it moderates young people, and it's actually better for life. But maybe that there's a function that older people serve in helping life to continue.
There is a grandparent hypothesis that the grandparents do help the survival of the grandparents.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I mean, that's more specific.
Yeah, that is more specific. The grandparents are helpful to the survival of the young.
Yeah, it's more specific than that. There seems to be some epigenetic inheritance Lamarckian in a way. This was from one of the professors who did the Joel Rothman, who's a professor of embryology, saying there's a study of the Dutch that show that the ones, the grandparents who faced starvation after World War I have passed on to their grandchildren more longevity on a statistical basis.
Yeah, so there may be other mechanisms by which life experience helps life further down the line. But I want to go further a little bit, okay? Because this is just setting up the important stuff, okay? This is just obvious. It's just I want to set everything up. You know, when you're making a theory, it has to be next. Everything has to be on the thing before it and solid, you know? So this is all preamble, okay? Just to be academic here, let me define these three terms. Sensation, perception of the environment, and communication within the organism. These are my definitions. Perception of the environment and communication within the organism. So that which has sensation can know what's going on outside it and adjust to what's going on outside it, and also know what's going on inside it, because we have inner sensations and adjust to those. So it helps life to be able to know what's out there, to know what's in here in order to adjust. Emotion, preparation for the immediate future based on what has been experienced in the past. Preparation for the immediate future based on what has been experienced in the past. That is, when you have feelings, they tell you what's likely to happen next based on your perception of the situation you're in and what has happened in similar situations. So as creatures get more sophisticated, they get more emotionally sophisticated, they get more able to draw a memory and predict what's going to happen next. So emotions are very important for higher animals because they tell a bear, don't go over there, bad things have happened over there. Go over there, you found food over there, and it looks like the same situation again. So it helps to steer us to have emotion. And then thought is plan. Let me see. If I do this, that will happen. If I do this, this will happen. If you look at your thought process, it's really a planning process. It's a process of trying to figure out the future based on what you know and what you expect to happen. So humans are the only ones that have thought to a major degree, but most higher animals have pretty good emotionality, and even very simple animals have sensation. The paramecium goes toward this and away from this. So humans use these three faculties to serve four basic needs. Now, this is where it gets interesting, and this is where it gets speculative. So far what I've said nobody would disagree with, but now if I say this in a psychological conference, the cabbages get thrown and people get because everybody has a different deal about what is basically motivating you and me. However, I have support for my position. So let me tell you my position, and I will tell you why everybody else is wrong and I'm right. Okay? Not everybody else is wrong, but okay, I think there are four basic needs.
Then I'm going to have to go to the other side.
Four basic needs are, let me see if I can get them on the thing here, okay?
High school opera.
No, that's a little different. Okay, that's so let's go.
Health.
What?
H-E-A-L-T-H. So health and safety.
There's your
is one, all right, we'll go like this. Two is pleasure. Three is selfhood, then the autonomy.
And four is connection.
Get to.
I'm going to tell you, I'm going to explain.
So these are our basic needs if we're going to continue as living creatures. Okay? I'll go through the four of them. Before I go through the four of them, the premise is that every moment of your life, you are working on satisfying one or more of these basic needs. If we look down in your psyche about why you're doing anything, why you're taking notes right now, why you're sitting in this class, why you're thinking about something else, anything, the basic motive is one of those, or more than one of those. Those are what supports your life, what you're always trying to do, which is stay alive. Okay? So let's talk about the four basic motives. Motive one, health and safety. That is... why did I push that chair aside? Health and safety. That was endangering my health and safety. Okay. So the point about it is, if something is threatening your health or your safety, you are motivated, you have to do something about it. You're motivated, if you're going to stay alive, to change that thing. So it's a basic motive that we have. We make sure, you know, I don't have enough food, or I got to get this, or I got to get shelter over my head, or I got to get a new lock for my door. Whatever it is, we are motivated to stay alive and pay attention to what our health is and what keeps us safe. Why do we watch the news? Because we're crazy. We watch the news because on the news is stuff that could affect our health and safety. And we want to know that stuff. And that's what they feed us, because we're compelled to pay attention to that. Right, so health and safety is number one. Number two, pleasure. This is often left out of lists of basic motives, but it's absolutely basic. Pleasure in nature, this is what we're going to get to in a minute. Pleasure in nature tells us what is life-giving. We're born with a sweet tooth. We're born not liking bitter taste. Why? Because in nature, what's sweet is generally healthy for us. What's bitter is generally poisonous. So kids are born already adapted for taking in the life-giving stuff and avoiding the life-taking stuff. So in nature, you can trust that pleasure is good. It will make your life increase. And displeasure will make your life decrease, so avoid it. So you approach pleasure and you avoid displeasure. The problem comes in the unnatural things that human beings have cooked up, which are extremely pleasurable but do not increase life. Things like cigarettes, cocaine, gambling, et cetera, et cetera. You know, binge watching, all these things, that, your phone, you know. So these, we're going to get to the basic place in your brain where the motive to approach is in the middle of your brain in the reward pathway, okay? That is, that dopamine pathway in the middle of your brain has to do with going toward that which is pleasurable. I want more of that. And in nature, that leads you to the good, to the stuff that supports your life. But it also leads us to stuff that doesn't support our life, that we've cooked up, that nature didn't cook up.
How about
right.
Risk-taking?
What?
Risk-taking, that, you know, that sort of going towards death in a way, it's giving you pleasure to...
People who take risks, we're going to get to that, that's a different motive, okay? So people take risks because it gives them something that is more important to their life than the risk potential. And that's three, okay? So first motive is health and safety. You're always working on that. Second motive is pleasure. And I'll talk about this a little bit more later, but the point is, if you don't have pleasure in your life, then your life is not increasing. Pleasure is a measure of how much your life is alive. So people who are lacking pleasure are denying themselves the goods of life. Third, selfhood. And I divide it, I parse it into three parts. You've got to have a sense of who you are. And that involves knowing who you are. This is me, that's not me. Being free to choose that which will increase your life. So autonomy means you get to move yourself around in life. You can steer yourself in the direction of that which is going to increase your life. And ability means you have the means to get that stuff. So you got to know who you are and what you need. I'm me and I need this. And I've got to have the freedom to go to get what I need. And I've got to have the ability to get what I need. So those three things I put together as selfhood. You need a sense of self. And people who don't have a sense of self go into therapy because they don't know who they are. They're typically not doing well in life because they don't have these qualities that motivate them to be more alive. Fourth, connection. You can't do it alone. Okay? It increases your life to be connected to other people as it increases their life. People, even people who meditate in caves for 3 years at a time, are connected to something more universal. Okay, it's not that they become more and more isolated, they become connected in a larger and larger and larger sense. Their compassion grows to be infinite. Rob.
I was stating that this is the perfect moment. I took this math class from this guy who actually had this in his PhD thesis, The Meaning of Life, and it was to maximize contact under the constraint of security. To maximize contact under the constraint of security.
I understand, you got 2 for 4. Unfortunately, he didn't get pleasure, right?
Well, in math, there's a thing called a constraint problem, where you actually can only maximize one parameter under a constraint.
Okay, got it. So that was it's a beautiful statement. Yeah. Okay, so Gordon and then I'm going to go on to give you illustrations of how this works in the real world and how it works. Now we're going to get to the important stuff, but Gordon.
Okay, I recently saw a talk on TV about connection or the danger of isolation and of people, especially older people. And it said, like, people that are disconnected from others, you know, in a big way, it's like smoking 15 cigarettes a day. That's the effect on people.
Yeah, it's a huge effect of longevity and health of being connected versus being disconnected. If you can look at the whole psycho-spiritual growth process as a growth process from ultimate isolation down here to ultimate connection here. Here you're all, you're connected to everything. Your compassion and your empathy are total. Here you're disconnected. Wait, one section. When you're down here, when you feel totally isolated, that's when people kill themselves. When they feel that no one cares, I don't matter at all. That's total disconnection, that's unbearable. And as you get psychologically healthier, you move from psychosis and ultimate distress to neurosis when you feel somewhat connected but somewhat disconnected. Did I do the right thing? Do they like me? Don't they like me? There's so much self-concern that there's not a lot of connection. A healthy person doesn't worry too much about herself or himself. There's more availability to other people. And as you grow to become a self-actualizing person, you really don't forget, you really kind of forget about yourself at all because you know you're fine and it's what you're doing and who you're connected to that are the dynamic of your life. And ultimately, if you're, I guess, a spiritually realized person, there is no difference between you and everything else. It's all one thing. So that's the whole deal about connection. Okay, so Julie was next, yeah.
Well, I feel isolated. I have the same problem and all that. I feel isolated.
But what you do about it is you come to class, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that's because you're motivated for connection. Why are we sitting here? We're sitting here for a bunch of reasons, but probably one reason is because it's really a good, it's a nice community that we have, you know? And there's a connection. You feel like there are people that are like me, that understand me, that I like, that, you know, that's a necessary thing. Sometimes I have had clients that I've had to kind of drag to class. Gotta come to class if you want to see, because I, not that it was, the class was so important, but that I wanted them to be out of their apartment and with other people. Anyway, let me talk a little bit about more about these things and what it shows about who we are and what we should do about each other. Okay, so I'm not the only person that's come to this conclusion. I cite two august references, or two august confirming theorists. One is the Hindu chakra system. Chakra one, root chakra, basic aliveness, health and safety. That's what root chakra is. Am I alive? Is my root in the earth? Am I getting my nourishment? Am I okay? Survival. Two, pleasure, second chakra. It's not just about sexuality, it's about pleasure in general. And it's without the ability to know what's good for you and bad for you, you don't grow. You don't have any third chakra. Okay? You got to know what to go for and what to go away from, and you got to be able to act on that. Otherwise, you wither. So, second chakra, third chakra. Right? In the Hindu system, sense of self. Solar plexus, will. Assimilation of the environment into you, you know, bringing in, digesting food so that you become stronger. Self. Third chakra. Being able to get, to have an identity, get what you want. That's all this. And fourth chakra, arms open, right? Heart and out this way. Connection to other people. Bringing in the world. Caring for the world. Moving out. I include the arms in the fourth chakra. Because it's obvious, right? You know, it's the heart goes out and it comes in. So that's the Hindu chakra system. What about the fifth, sixth, and seventh? They're combinations of the lower chakras. They're putting together the lower chakra. Lower chakras. For example, the fifth chakra about self-expression, that's a higher octave of sattva and of pleasure also. Similarly for sixth and seventh. What about Maslow's hierarchy of motives? Remember that triangle you had to learn in Psych 100 and Psych 1? Used to be Psych 1, now it's Psych 100. Shows you what's happening to the world. They put two more digits on it just to make it more complex. Remember, how many of you took Psych 1? Yeah. I taught Psych 1. Now I teach Psych 100. Shows you. So anyway, Maslow's hierarchy of motives. First is physiological needs, the lowest level needs, the most basic needs, physiological needs, the need for food and water. Second level is safety needs, the need for for a stable environment and protection from the elements. So I put them together, health and safety here. I put them together, but he has one and two. And then his third one is esteem, third one is love and belongingness needs. So his third one is this one. And his fourth one is esteem needs, this one. And then his fifth one is self-actualization, which is not really a need. It's a need to give rather than need to get. So what did he leave out?
Pleasure.
Why did he leave out pleasure? He actually didn't. If you read a small print, he talked about it, but he didn't specify it on an equal level to the others, because he was writing in the 1950s for academic audiences, and pleasure was not a nice word. Instead, it wasn't fashionable to talk about pleasure. And they used to, when they did research on love, they couldn't call it love. They had to come up with all kinds of other, like Carl Rogers called it unconditional positive regard. Because if he said unconditional love, people would say, oh, that stinks, that's not scientific. It's true. So Maslow did actually talk about pleasure as being part of his hierarchy. He just didn't distinguish it. But other than that, he's parallel. So I have these two very different sources kind of agreeing with this. So.
Yeah. Okay, so. So this is, now we're starting to come to the moral to the story, okay? I'll read what I wrote the other night. These needs are always legitimate. These needs are always legitimate. That is, they are what our life is asking of us at every moment. In conflicts between individuals or groups, countries, any other group, when in conflicts between individuals or groups, the only question should be about strategy. So if you're having an argument with your kid or your parent or your brother or sister or your significant other, the mistake would be to say, you're wrong. That's wrong. People can't help but express these needs. It's what they need. So you have to realize that anybody that's contending with you is trying to be alive. And you have to say, I understand that you're expressing basic needs.
You got to listen to me. I'm expressing basic needs. What we have to talk about is a strategy so that we can both get our needs met. That's what we should be talking about. I should be honoring you where you're coming from, because you can't help but come from a life place. And you should be honoring where I'm coming from, because I can't help but come from that place. We ought to talk about whether what we're doing is helping us to get our needs met. What I'm telling you is, if you keep making nuclear weapons, that probably isn't going to be in your interest or my interest to survive. Okay, so let's talk about maybe getting nuclear weapons off the earth, because it's in both of our interests. So we're talking about the strategy, we're not talking about the motive. If a person says, Kim Jong-un says, I'm going to make nuclear weapons, what he's saying is, I want my country to be safe, and if I need to get a bigger club to do that, I'll do it. So instead of saying he's a demon, you say, well, why is this person pursuing that course? And could we convince that person that a better course for health and safety would be to get on the economic bus with the rest of us, because that's where the world is really going, you know? And if you put down your nuclear weapons, these are the economic benefits that accrue. You want health and safety? You want to be like South Korea and have riches as opposed to no electricity? Get on the bus this way, instead of saying, you're bad. There's something wrong with you for coming from that place. So understand how this changes all kinds of therapeutic and international interactions. You have to realize that people can't help but come from legitimate motives. But the question is whether their strategy is going to meet their needs and yours.
Okay. Yeah, Michael. The model of nonviolent communication put together by Marshall Rosenberg talks a lot about the problems that happen when we confuse the strategies for needs.
Yeah. Those of you who know Marshall's work, he has many more needs, but it's the same idea. I mean, you got to come to this understanding. So, Reed.
That is also the core of the philosophy of the Harvard Negotiation Project.
Yeah.
The book, Getting to Yes,
yes.
Getting to No, Difficult Conversations, that is the very basic core theme of the whole.
Yeah. This is the Harvard Negotiation Project. The idea is, how do you negotiate successfully? How do you get to yes when you affirm the legitimacy of everybody's motive, and you talk about how to get to an agreement that maximizes the benefit? So let me go a little further, and then we'll look at some examples. All right, we'll go a little further, and then we'll look at some examples, and then we'll go a little further after that. Okay, so when the basic needs are met, when these four needs are adequately met, and life is maintained or increased, we are happy. When at least one of the basic needs is unmet and life is challenged or decreased, we are unhappy. So when you're not happy, or somebody else that you're talking to is not happy, it's because one or more of these needs is not being met. Happiness comes about as a result of the needs being adequately met. So if you're not happy, you have to ask yourself, what am I basic thing am I not getting? And if I could get that, what my mood would change. So if a person is depressed, you can give them a pill and it will lessen their depression, maybe. But if you want them to not be depressed, there's no hocus pocus you can do. You have to look at their life and you have to say, what in your life is not feeding what you need? And if we can feed what you need, your depression will lift. It's not an organic problem. There might be some kind of depression that has to do with some organic cause and you have to medicate forever. But for most of the depression or anxiety that we experience, that most people experience, it's not about something wrong inside our brains. It's about something wrong outside our life, in our lives. That is, something in our life is not giving us life. And if we change that, we don't change we change the mood. So it's not a therapy shouldn't be a question mostly of changing the individual. It should be a question of empowering the individual to make the requisite changes in the life. The metaphor I use for this is, let's say that you're growing and your shoe is pinching your foot. If you go to a shrink will give you a pill to shrink your foot back to fit your shoe. That's what they do. But if you are growing, wouldn't it be better to find somebody to take you to the store to get a new, larger, more comfortable pair of shoes? That means looking at your life and seeing where it's constraining you, and then changing the life, helping you to change your life so that you can continue to grow. It's a huge, it's a fundamental difference in the way we look at therapy, for example. As a medical model, you're okay, you break down, we give you some treatment, and you're back to where you were. The growth model is, life is an ascending process, and it goes like this, and sometimes when it's bumpy, you need a little guidance to get back on the upward gyre. Michael.
A powerful way of looking at this, again, Marshall Rosenberg, is that you could see anger, for example, as a gift because it's pointing to one of those needs that's not getting met.
Of course, anger tells you that something is threatening you, and you have emotions. These things come up in order to motivate you to change what needs to be changed. You've heard me say this probably ad nauseum, but Chögyam Trungpa said, the shit of your neurosis is the fertilizer of your enlightenment. Right? Remember that? That's Trungpa. And what he meant by that is your symptoms show you where the shoe is pinching your foot and you got to make changes in your life. So symptoms are not something you want to medicate out of existence. They're something you want to use to motivate you. When somebody doesn't have a symptom, they don't change. But when it hurts, you move. So symptoms are seen as valuable because they impel you to make needed growth steps. We can look at the varieties of happiness and unhappiness as fulfillment of these or lack of various of these. For example, a person who is really successful at work, a workaholic, who doesn't have social connection and gets it by social media, which is a simulacrum and doesn't really do the trick, okay, it's not a real social connection, that person can be rich and healthy. That person can have a lot of pleasure in their work. That person can have a really good sense of selfhood. Oh, that's the best, blah, 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 blah. You know, a lot of money coming to you. But if there's not the real connection, that person's going to be unhappy, even with all that expertise and riches. Similarly, a person that has good connection but doesn't have the rest of these is going to be happy because connection is so fundamental, but there's still going to be an insecurity about how do I feed my family. So, Chris.
Yeah, what about when it's really the perception of a need not being met that's more the cause, as far as like you know the safety is there, the abundance is there, it can be there, but there's a kind of a narrative running behind of insecurity or that it's a scarcity world, and so when that's at hand, is it just like a lack of connection with the larger truth of who we are and what's going on?
The motive is still to feel secure, but the therapy wouldn't be to change the life, it would be to change the view of the life. So I simplified too much. The two things therapy does is it changes the way you look at your life, or it changes how you construct your life. So I should have included that, but I wanted to make it clearer, but absolutely, sometimes what we do in therapy is help people look more clearly at what really is rather than their screwed up view of it. Bill, and then Jordan.
Did Maslow talk about the opposite of this. So let's say you put someone in prison, they have none of this, and would this, could someone live 50 years without any of this? Would it actually kill someone, or it would certainly mess them up?
Maybe, except people in prison, they establish connections, they make groups, and sometimes they make really positive groups as well as negative groups. Their sense of selfhood, they know where they stand in the prison system, and they have jobs to do, and they have a hierarchy. These motives are basic. Now, they're not as happy as if they could do this out in the real world, but they attempt to get themselves alive and reasonably happy in a situation where it's hard to do that. But they actively are working on these things because this is what you have to do to be alive.
Yeah.
But we if we wanted them to be better, we wouldn't put them in a life-denying situation. We would put them in a life-affirming situation so that they grew beyond whatever screwed-upness got them to do bad things.
Right. Is there pleasure in prison?
Of course there's pleasure in prison.
There's
two kinds of pleasure in prison that I know of. One is there's a lot of drugs that get smuggled in. That's always what you read about anyway. I've been there, but it's a lot of drugs. And secondly, there's a lot of homosexual behavior. Morty.
Is it naive on my part to think that the variable that comes to mind with all this is new? Express that is trust. Someone could actually utilize these factors to benefit themselves, even though they no longer are true in the sense that they're not being executed as they should be, but only as they want to be. Like a Trump, who is, they have us assume that things are what he would say they are, but those of us who know better know they aren't. And most of us don't know.
So if you can look at anybody's behavior. You can look at anybody's behavior and you can explain it in terms of these motives. And what you have to talk about with the person is the legitimacy of the motives, but look at what the strategy is doing to yourself and look at what the strategy is doing to other people. But you affirm the person first. Okay, let's go a little further. So for you, again, for your own mood and the mood of the people closest to you, happy or unhappy, you can look at it very simply. You can say, what here isn't getting met adequately, and that shows me what is making me less than fully happy. So it's a very simple way to understand a complex thing, which is your mood. So let's talk about approach avoid a little more, okay? Because we're not just happy or unhappy. We have various gradations of emotion. They said happy and unhappy are kind of an overall sum. But let's look at the various gradations. It turns out that there, now this is where I'm really speculative, even though I'm totally convinced I'm right. There are a lot of emotion researchers that all have their own theories about how many basic emotions there are. In my Psych 100 textbook, there are four different lists of basic emotions which don't agree. And they just throw the four lists together because there's no way to... They don't think there's any way to distinguish. But let me show you my list of the basic emotions based on approach and avoid. Okay. Again, I ran out of words, but these are the basic strategies of life, the basic things we need to do. We need to go toward that which gives life, away from that which takes life. So these are the basic emotions that come up
for approach and avoidance. There are four for approach and three for avoidance. We got to get motivated to go get that which will give us life. We got to find food, we got to find a mate, we got to find shelter, we got to find those things which are life-giving. So we need an activation of the system. And that's the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, and that's the dopamine reward pathway in the middle of the brain, which gets us looking, gets us out there to find the goods of life. So excitement. And there are many, you know, underneath excitement, there are all kinds of sub emotions, but they all can be subsumed as an excitement, a longing, a desire, a passion, a craving, whatever. Excitement. Then when you find that which you've been seeking,
enjoyment,
which is the act of consuming. So first you go looking for it, and then you take it in. And that increases your love. So neuroscience, I'm hesitant to go here, because neuroscience is really complicated. And anything you say about it is a simplification, and often an egregious one. But if this has to do with the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system and the dopamine-driven reward pathway, this one has to do with the endorphins, the things that get released in your brain when it's good. Okay. Then, once you've sought it and you've consumed it, then we need a mechanism for turning off more seeking for a while so that you can digest and rest. And so that is contentment. And I put down incorporating, rest and digest. You know, a person that never rests and digests burns herself or himself out. You got to be able to turn this off and allow that life to be incorporated. So these are the contentment motives: satisfaction, fulfillment, peacefulness, contentment. And finally, so this has to do with, amongst other things in the brain, the serotonin, the neurotransmitter serotonin, which, you know, when you eat for comfort and you eat enough carbohydrates, then you feel better. That's the serotonin serotonin activating areas of your brain. So this is dopamine in the sympathetic nervous system. This is endorphins. This is serotonin. And this one, this one is, I'll show you, Karen. And that would be,
how would you describe the difference between men and women in this category?
I'm going to talk about it right at this. That was perfect timing, Jay. I'm going to talk about that right now. The last one I put down is caring. That is caring for others, nurturing others, love. Okay, and that seems to be mediated especially by oxytocin. That is when a father sees his newborn child, there's a rush of oxytocin. When a mother breastfeeds, there's a rush of oxytocin. When you make love to somebody and have an orgasm, there's a rush of oxytocin and you feel family.
Oxytocin is the bonding hormone. And what's different between men and women is we both have oxytocin, but men have a lot more testosterone, which is opposite than oxytocin. And that testosterone says, get out there and pollinate another flower, you know? And oxytocin says, hang around here and protect this one. So it's not that men don't have this motive, they have the other motive too. And so women have are more able to do this consistently than men. That's one way to look at the differences. There are other differences too, I'm sure. So those are the four, so that's oxytocin. Those are the four for approach, avoid. So all these basic emotions have to be there. If you don't have any of these, you're missing something that you need for your life. These are the basic ways you approach the life-giving stuff. So if you're blocked in any of these, you're blocking some aspect of your life.
What you just said about women and the nurturing and all that, I think that women should be more women in politics, huh?
Well, that's, yeah. Of course, and that's changing. There are more women in politics, and in the woman used to be that nobody went, if you were a woman, only a very few women went to law school. People who come from law school become lawyers, and then they become legislators, and they run the world. Now the percentage of law school graduates is between 75-80% female, which is completely changing the law from a confrontational to a more cooperative mediation-based arrangement, and it's also going to change the world's politics if we can get there in time, if the dinosaurs don't kill us first. All right. Here are the basic motives. Okay, fear. Okay. You gotta run away from that which will eat you. So fear is valuable. If you're feeling fear, it's saying that there's something threatening in your world, something that you need to get away from, if possible. Okay? So fear is not a bad thing. Fear tells you that something could be taking your life. So if you don't pay attention to what you fear, you make stupid mistakes. Teenagers frequently don't have their brains wired up enough to be afraid of that which they should be afraid of, and so they break a lot of bones and hearts.
Real quick on the topic. But fear, there's different kinds of fear. Like, for example, I have a fear of losing my partner. Now, how do you deal with that kind of fear? How do you run away from that kind of fear?
The impulse would be, when you're afraid of something, that's a good question. So you're afraid of losing Let me think. You're afraid of losing your partner. So you want to run away from the loss, so you run toward your partner to hold her. So it motivates you to run away from the bad event and instead run toward the prevention of that. That's the best I can do for that right now. We'll think about it.
How about my phobias?
Phobias are fears of things that you don't really need to fear. They're an exaggeration of the normal fear process in the brain. Okay, so the basic system here is the dopamine system and associated systems to get you to go. The reward pathway gets you to go toward the good stuff. The basic mechanism here is fight or flight. The hippocampus, the amygdala, the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system, which gets you ready to run or fight. So, fear, anger, which it is. Anger is resisting.
What?
Fight, flight, or
flow
also.
Yeah, it's actually fight, flight, or freeze, but I've got a different one, okay. So resisting. People who have learned never to get angry, it's impolite. It's not, you're not a good little boy or a good little girl to get angry. And so they learn to suppress their anger. they don't have the motive to resist that which is threatening to them. So they don't defend themselves. If you don't have anger, you don't have determination, you don't have courage, you don't make changes that need to be made. You know, it's out of anger that we change the world. You say, this is not okay, and we're going to march, and we're going to write, and we're going to demonstrate, and we're going to maybe do other stuff we have to do to keep this from happening, because this is threatening to our families. So anger is important. It tells you that something is threatening, and you need to take action and do something about it. So one response to thinking about losing your partner is, what can I do to prevent that from happening? That's anger. I'm determined. I'm going to... All right, and the third one is... This is the one that people misunderstood the most. Sadness. That's the third of the so-called negative emotions. And so when you're sad, it means that you have lost something. It's surrendering, being at the mercy of life. You know, in nature, when there's a fight between two creatures, when one over something like a mate or food, when one loses, typically in nature, that one exposes its throat or it let's go. It stops the fight. And that stops the fight. The other one doesn't kill it because it's got what it needs. And this one has thrown itself on the mercy of life. It said, I've lost. So sadness is a response to loss. And sometimes that's you have to do that. You know, if something happens and you've lost something close to you, you just grieve. You just say, you throw yourself open. You put yourself on the mercy of life. So if you're not willing to be sad, you're not willing to trust life, to open to healing in life. So, Krista.
I think a lot in our culture, we tend to have black and white words, you know, and sadness is kind of a black word, like the dark, the bad. But it's interesting that in Eastern culture, the word sat, which is the root of this, actually means truth and the essential goodness. So that ability to feel sorrow, sadness, even the word satiate comes from the word sat, yes, which means the essential truth and connecting with that. So when the words aren't so black and white, we see the value. There's a whole book called The Gifts of Saturn. Because even that word Saturn comes from Saturn.
Yeah. And I always thought that Saturn had a bad math astrologically. It's actually very beautiful. It's about order and form. It's not about strength.
Yeah.
So Chris.
I kind of feel uncomfortable seeing the word surrendering, as I associated in spirituality with accepting what you can't control, whereas this is more in terms of giving up.
No, it's as Chris has said, it's more surrendering to a larger larger possibility. It's like I've lost this. I have to kind of open up to the mercy of something beyond my own devices.
Which is
spiritual. So it's kind of like so what Eckhart Tolle said at the end of The Power of Now. He said, surrender is the basic understanding here. You know, you let go of trying to rearrange your life all the time, and you open up to the possibility that there's something beyond you that supports life.
So even being at the mercy of life, you mean it has a positive connotation?
Yeah, you throw yourself on the mercy of life. Life is merciful. All right, so, Morty.
So the way I guide my life is you or you. You meaning unique to me, and I have control over it, or you being universal, and I'm at the mercy of it, because it's much little I can do about it.
You, it's like I and I that Rasta is used, but you and you.
All right, so so given this, let me see if there's anything else. Okay. Okay, so given this framework that we've just gone through, the basic understanding from which all else flows is that we have these basic needs. And they're always what we're doing. At any moment, you can ask yourself, why am I doing what I'm doing? And you will find one or more of these needs motivating your behavior. They're what motivates your life. And then the question always becomes, how well am I doing at getting these needs met? And your emotions and your overall mood tell you that. They tell you what's succeeding or not about your strategies for getting these needs met. Further, anybody else that you deal with, you have to fundamentally realize that they're coming from the same place as you. They just want to stay alive. And if they're doing stuff that is preventing you from getting your needs met, then you have to say, hey, I respect that you're trying to get your needs met, but you have to let me get my needs met too. The deal is, the most life needs to survive here. So anybody understanding anybody else has to do with understanding the basic legitimacy of their motives and questioning the efficacy of their strategies. So what do you want to say about this? We can give some examples if you want about. So this is the schema. You can understand anything from this, why you do whatever you do, and why it's working or isn't working, and why you feel the way you feel. So questions or comments? Okay, so let's see. Bob is first. We'll go this way.
Okay, you have an asymmetry then. Can you talk about the hormones that are operating at a subconscious level under approach? Is something like adrenaline hormone that affects fear and anger, or the hormones that go to that side?
Oh, okay, so I just called it, let's go back, because I can go through that, Bob. And again, neuroscience is complicated, it isn't just hormones, it's circuits that go through many brain parts. I just emphasized one aspect of it. So this is fight or flight. So what happens in the fight or flight mechanism, what happens when these things are activated, okay, is, you perceive what's going on out there in the world. It goes into the middle of your brain, into the thalamus, which is the sensory switchboard in the middle of your brain. It goes directly, before you think about it, it goes to the hippocampus, like a horseshoe in the middle of your brain, where you do a really quick check. Did you ever see anything like this before? What happened? That's where memory is in one place. The memory is in the hippocampus. So before you think about it, so I'm walking down the road, or I'm walking down the trail, and I see out the corner of my eye what looks like a snake. In an instant, it goes into the middle of my brain, goes to the hippocampus, which says, hey, that could be a snake. It's coiled, and it's over, you know. And then the amygdala at the end of the hippocampus. The hippocampus is like a horseshoe, and at the end of the horseshoe is two almond-shaped structures called the amygdala. There's actually two of them, but we call it the amygdala. It should be called the amygdala. And the amygdala immediately send a message to the body to prepare for fight or flight. And that message is sent by the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system throughout the body. And one thing that the sympathetic branch of the autonomic nervous system does is it activates the adrenal medulla, the middle of the adrenal glands, and they release adrenaline and noradrenaline into the bloodstream. And that immediately, well it's immediate. This is the fast system. The fast system goes like this, like that, instantly. And then you go,
as the adrenaline pours through your bloodstream. Meanwhile, more slowly, the information has made its way up to your cerebral cortex, where it is processed more thoroughly, but more slowly. And then you go like this, you go, and they go, oh my God, that was just a stick. Because now, 2 seconds later, the cerebral cortex has said, wait a minute, I misinterpreted that emergency signal. So it's a two-phase process by which avoidance happens. You need an immediate process just in case it's something going to eat you right then. And in more intelligent animals, you want to be able to not be governed by the instinctive reaction. You want to say, wait a minute, I don't really have to be afraid of that. I can approach rather than avoid that. But it's that fight or flight mechanism that gets set off for this. That's a little bit more complex about it. Okay. So, Michael.
There's another aspect to strategies. To help get our strategies met, to make them successful, we have requests. Requests that we make of ourselves and others. And a danger is that when these requests become demands. And the way to tell if it's a demand or not is if when you make a request, if you're okay with a no, it was really a request. But if you get pissed off, whatever, at a no, then it was truly a demand. And demands never happen.
Yeah, so that's why when countries demand of one another, you got to do this, then it's there won't be any agreement. But when countries request, it would be better for both of us if we adopted this strategy, then there's a possibility. Countries, couples, whatever. I think that it's... Okay, so thank you for bearing with this discussion. What I want you to take out of it is that you're always coming from a life-affirming place. But the question is whether the way that you're living your life is meeting your needs and the needs of others, or whether somehow you've learned strategies which are no longer meeting your needs or never met your needs. Understood? So the question you ask yourself is, am I happy? And if not, what are my predominant emotions that are showing me what's not working? And how do I better meet the legitimate needs that I have? You can't, there's no way around the needs, okay? Less than. There is no way to not be working on these needs. If you say, I'm not gonna have that need, it's just gonna go underground, it's just gonna go unconscious. You can't not have those needs. You're a living creature, and your life demands these things of you. The question is, are you, with your intelligence, cooperating with your motivation, or are you getting in your own way? Barry?
I think 1, 2, and 4, at least to me, are very apparent, and then I'm stuck down at 3.
That's the one that seems less basic, but it isn't. What's the guy's name? What's his name?
Are you talking about the wife? No, you
won't remember. Okay, there's a preacher who gathered together many minority people in the LA Coliseum some years ago. I can't believe I can't remember his name right now. But in any event, he had the whole 75,000 people gathered in the LA Coliseum chanting, I am somebody, I am somebody, I am somebody.
Jesse Jackson?
Jesse Jackson, yeah. And why did people chant that so powerfully? Because they felt like they were not seen in the culture. They felt like they didn't have an identity. And not having an identity is the worst possible thing. If you want your kid to feel the worst, you ignore your kid. That's worse than if you yell at your kid, you know? We need to feel that we exist. And we need to feel that it's okay to be who we are. Many of us have learned that it's not okay to be us. That's where we're going next week with our little exercise, is how many of us are actually authentic? Or have we learned that it's not okay to be the identity that we really are? And that cripples the whole life. So next week will be an explication of this. Bernie.
Well, it's hard to understand, and this is very intellectual, very, very intelligent. Why is it the monkeys and everything else that we have to write this down and analyze? They just intuitively know what to do.
You repeat the question.
The question is, why do the monkeys and the creatures, why do they get it right? And why do they not have to intellectualize about this? Because, first of all, they don't always get it right, and so they act to get it right. They war with one another sometimes, they steal one another's food, they do whatever it takes to get this stuff. But because they have a less complex society, there is less constraint on their natural functioning.
And the strongest survive also.
Yeah, right, and we try to have everybody survive. But because we have a more complex society, we have more prohibition about acting our natural selves. That's Freud's theory in a nutshell, right? Civilization is discontent. He said, when you live with other people, you have to kind of turn down your own nature. And if you turn it down enough, it's called neuroses. Neurosis.
President,
I'm going to
sample for the next big one question, and I don't
understand
what we're
going
to do
next. Nope. You're just
going to come and surprise. Oh,
yeah, surprise. Okay, so again, to say this one too many times, when you think about your own life, think about whether or not you're satisfying the needs that you have as a living creature, and if not, figure out strategies to satisfy those needs, because there's no way around it. Okay. Yeah, so wait, let me